Exactly. Exactly.
It's one of my favorite stories from Ajahn Chah. It has nothing to do with the teaching, but just so that it's not an inside joke, we'll start with that story from Ajahn Chah. Because it really helped me in my meditation practice. We often do our daily meditation and even our sitting groups in a world of sounds. And sometimes we label those sounds noise. So I found this teaching from Ajahn Chah very helpful. There's different versions of it, and they're often told in very truncated form. I'm interested in going back to the source material and pulling back some of the details that may have been lost as we retold the same story over and over and over again. So one of the ways that the story goes is that Ajahn Chah was sitting deep in meditation in the woods outside a village. And it was definitely a period of time when his resolve was strong. He was going for full awakening and enlightenment. And so he decided he would stay out in the woods until he got enlightened, and he would stay out and he'd meditate all night, and the nighttime would be a great time to meditate. I imagine him thinking, because among other reasons, it would be quiet. But no. He happened to choose a particular period of time, which happens quite frequently in Thailand, when there was a festival in the village. Many, many festivals in Thailand. And so the party went on all night. And you know how it goes when the neighbor turns on their lawnmower when you're trying to meditate, or whatever it is. And at first you sort of take a breath, okay, it is what it is. And then the reactivity starts to grow. And that's what happened with Ajahn Chah. This is reassuring. If this happened with Ajahn Chah, I think we're going to be okay. And so reactivity started, and he started to have thoughts like, I wish they'd be quiet. And then the thoughts grew into, don't they know that there's a meditation master in the forest trying to get enlightened? How could they be carrying on like this? At that point, he realized that it had become far up the ladder of reactivity, is the way that I label it, and that something there needed to be a different response. And he had one of those amazing insights that we sometimes have that come out of nowhere in our meditation practice, and it was very simple, and yet it changed everything. And the thought was, who's bothering who? Is the sound coming in and bothering me, or am I going out and bothering the sound? Who's bothering who? So being a system, being a body-mind system myself that happens to be extremely sensitive to sound, that was very helpful. Now, your door sensitivity might not be sound, it might be smells. You're really sensitive to things that stink various ways. Or it might be that visually you get consumed or overwhelmed in various ways. We're all different with where we're sensitive. But who's bothering who? In that way, and this is the part that often isn't told in the story, he was able to continue his meditation. And what happened as he continued his meditation is that his mind started to become more and more quiet. And out of that quiet, a luminosity arose, a knowing arose, things started to release in his mind. You know, the way I think about it is sometimes there's this pendulation process that as far as we open, we contract, and as far as we lock down, there's potential for opening. And when I listen to his story, I think of that, and I go, oh, his mind went into lockdown, and then it was able to open into something much larger. And he describes it as an impactful cycle in his meditation practice. And so, as he continued teaching, he often told the story about who's bothering who, in the hopes that perhaps his experience and insight could help others. So, I shared that story probably in very brief form in the cover letter of the Mountain Stream Meditation newsletter, which is where the inside joke came from. Now, if you're interested in the sound of silence, that's the topic of the article in the newsletter. And so we've got relative sounds that arise and pass away and can be known in awareness. And then in this practice, this tradition, this knowing quality comes straight out of the forest of Thailand. It's called the sound of silence. People experience it different ways. And it's not dependent on there being noise or no noise. So some people experience it as like a low-level hum. It's not the refrigerator, and it's not tinnitus. It's not a medical event. Some people don't hear it. They feel it somatically. It's a sense. And for some people, it's way too esoteric, and they have no access to it at all. So if you're interested in more about that, check out the newsletter. So that was an incredibly divergent preamble, because it has nothing to do with what I thought I'd reflect on tonight. And yet it's all the same. It doesn't matter. I brought a reflection on even a completely different topic than sound and sound of silence and what I'm going to reflect on. And as I was driving from the Women's Weekend retreat that I finished teaching at 4:30 to here, I realized quite clearly that the reflection that I brought, I wasn't going to offer. It wasn't current. I just came out of hours of ritual in a small circle of women. And so there's a vulnerability there, there's a rawness, there's an immediacy that notes could not begin to access. So we'll leave it in the folder. Then I got very curious when I heard that you all were just beginning to chant the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness. I really appreciate it about you as a community that you, I'm sure not every one of you, but as a community, you love to chant, you're open to chanting, you're open to receiving the teachings and the practices through the sound of the voice. In the community, sharing the sound of the voice, it inspires me. A lot of communities aren't interested or whatever. So I want to support that. And therefore I asked, oh, you're just starting to chant the Buddha's words on loving kindness. Have you had one of your visiting teachers offer some reflections on the sutta, on the Buddha's words? And the answer was, no. You know, maybe 10 years ago, Philip, but no. I thought, oh, great, okay, that's what I'll do. Because I love the sutta, and I love the heart practices. I didn't realize until I started teaching that I was unusual in the sense that in the cumulative 2.5 years of silent retreat that I've engaged in my adult life, half of that, just about, has been training in heart practices, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. I thought everybody did it that way, but apparently not. So I'll offer some initial reflections on the sutta, and I would highly encourage you to find out of your visiting teachers who are coming in the next season who else feels passionate about this, and they can add their own reflections. And of course, as you keep chanting it, you will have your reflections. And so we'll leave time for that at the end. So as I said before, I'm extremely interested, both as a practitioner and as a teacher, in going back to some of the more fully elicited material that we often get sound bites out of. What was the backstory of that sound bite? One that I loved to do research on recently is that famous line, in this fathom-long body, the whole of the Dharma is revealed. There are some incredible backstories to that that I'll tell you another night. I'll tell you that one of the backstories of the Metta Sutta. Because we weren't there, and so we can't say exactly what happened. But this is one that's attributed to the arising of this teaching. And it has a lot to teach us. It is definitely a once upon a time story. Once upon a time, 2,550 years ago, give or take, there were a group of monastics. It was early June, the beginning of the summer. How do I know that? Not because the source material says so, but the story begins just before the monsoon in India. The monsoon in India begins June 15th, give or take a week or two. It was just before the rains, and there were a group of monastics who were about to go into rains retreat. Now, rains retreat is the three-month retreat where the monastics don't travel, because if you have been to India or any country that monsoons, even to this day, it's hard to travel. We get incredible storms here, and every once in a while they mimic a monsoon temporarily, but this thing goes on and off and on for 3 months. So, time to go into retreat. Their teacher is the Buddha. How many of you have sat a residential retreat before? That is great. I really invite you, if you haven't, to consider it at the right time when it feels supportive. But most of us have. So imagine you're showing up at your residential retreat, and it's not just any monk up there, it's the Buddha. Can you even imagine that? What I'm interested in is actually living through these stories, living our practice through these stories. Think about the person on the planet that is the most inspiring to you in terms of wisdom. And you're sitting with them in an intimate encounter. And that's what happened. They went to go receive their instructions for this retreat from the Buddha. And the Buddha gave them instructions in concentration practice, samadhi. And they went up into the foothills of the Himalayas to find a place to practice. Now, the foothills of the Himalayas are about the level of Dharamsala, India, 8,000 feet. Himalayas themselves started about 11,500 and go up from there. They went, they found a village that was friendly. And the village was available not just to offer them food during their retreat, not just to offer them medicines should they happen to get sick, but they were even willing to build them kutis, or small huts, to practice in. So these monks had it made. Conditions were ideal. And so when we reflect back on our own lives, we can think about when conditions have been ideal for a meditation or a meditation retreat or a deepening of our spiritual path. It's an incredible feeling. We're filled with gratitude if we happen to notice that the conditions are ideal. These monastics did. They were grateful. They settled down into their retreat, and they started gathering, collecting, settling the mind-body system in samadhi. What, of course, they didn't know, those of you that know this story in its truncated form, is that the forest where their cabins, their kutis were, was inhabited by unseen beings. Okay? Unseen beings that in the tradition are called devas, in the Western tradition we might call them angels. But what I want to suggest is that we don't have to believe anything, but that most of us have experienced that there's more going on than meets the physical eye. And part of our spiritual path actually shows us that, that the eye sense door is limited. So the forest was inhabited by devas who, like anybody, when they have guests come to visit, were at first quite happy and supportive to have these cabins built and these monastics practicing, and after a while, it's like the house guest that won't leave. Coming up on Thanksgiving in a couple months. House guests that won't leave. And so in their own reactivity, they started plotting ways to get the monks out of there. The first thing that they did was the fear tactic. That's an obvious one. And you can hold this story internally, externally, or both. Okay? So it can work in the mind, it can work in the physical world, or both. They tried scare tactics. I'm sure some of us have backpacked or camped in the woods. You're out, it's dark, you're quiet, especially if you're alone, and then crack the branch, orienting, what just happened, am I okay, should I take a breath, should I run like hell, what's going on here? They tried that tactic, but the monks were too deep in samadhi and concentration, and they weren't moved by the scare tactic of sound. So they didn't move into reactivity. They didn't even have to go into who's bothering who. It was just settled, still, blissful, collected, sweetness, peace. So the devas tried plan B. And plan B was to stink them out. Now, I had an experience of smell that brought plan B in this story to a different level of me. For me, I live in the country now. And something, sadly, got in under or around the bottom of the house and died last year. And it started to smell. Many of us who live in the country have had little things die and it smells. But I'm sorry to say, I think this thing was big. Because it started to smell, and then the smell grew. And a week later, it's worse. And a week later, I kid you not, it's even worse. I don't know how that's possible. It was really, really smelly, to the point that you'd walk in the house and the whole system would just contract against the smell. And then you have to kind of relax and peel out and familiarize with something that's totally unpleasant so you can settle and open again. We tried to find it. We couldn't find it, whatever it was. So the devas tried to stink the monks out, and that got their attention, but it didn't get them out. And so the final tactic you can take with a grain of salt, but I think that we've all had this happen internally. The scare tactic was to produce frightening images and thoughts in the monastics' minds, which scared them so badly that they ran down the mountain in the foothills of the Himalayas to their teacher. We've all had the experience of sitting quietly minding our own business, and some thought or conglomerate comes in and completely shocks us, knocks us off our center, or somewhere else. What happened? 5 minutes ago, it was mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now we're in distress. And that's what happened to them externally. They ran down the hill and they said, "Teacher, teacher, it is too noisy, it is too stinky, it is too scary. This is the wrong place to meditate. This is the wrong practice you've given us. It's all wrong." And that's what happens when those mind states of aversion and fear start to arise. It fills the whole world. We glue the fear aversion glasses on our face, and that's what we've got. We look around and everything cooperates. It's all scary, annoying, and unsatisfactory. And we don't know we have the glasses on. Fortunately, their teacher was the Buddha, and he said, "Friends, that is the perfect place to meditate. It's the perfect cabin, perfect situation, and have I got a practice for you? Loving kindness. This is what should be done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, and burdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove." He continues. We don't actually know how the Buddha trained those monks in loving kindness. We do know the next part of the sutta, which I'll sing to you so that you stay with me at the end of a long day. And the tune is not the tune that we chant, which is very simple. It's three notes. You go up, you go down, or you stay in the center, as it was said. But this tune was developed by my friend and colleague, Kevin Griffin. Does Kevin ever come and teach here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he is great with Dharma music as well as with Dharma talks. And so he put it to music, and when we taught together for 10 years, we would sing it at the end of our retreats. And he calls it the Metta Samba. And so, right? And so here's the how-to part. The part that I just mentioned to you is a reflection and a cultivation of basic integrity. How we cultivate and manifest integrity in our thoughts, words, and actions. That's part one. We could call it the Sila part in the Eightfold Path, right? And I often look at this as the Eightfold Path model. We've got the integrity part, And then we've got the meditation part, the samadhi part, and then we've got the wisdom part at the end, the panya part. So here's the how-to that we have. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be. Whether they are weak or strong, omitting not a single one, the great, the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease, at ease, at ease, may they be at ease. I sing it because it's about the heart. I sing it because it's a whole body experience, this metta. We're not just saying phrases of well-wishing. We create these opportunities for gaps, for pause in the midst of dropping in well-wishes so that we can feel the somatic echo of what's being elicited. And sometimes the somatic echo is metta, friendliness, loving kindness, benevolence, and sometimes it's the exact opposite. Because we've created a field of kindness and friendliness that is resilient enough and vast enough for everything that gets in the way of our metta to come, to be recognized, to be bared witness to, and to be transformed in that field of metta. So that's one of the things that we know that the Buddha taught about loving kindness. But those of us who do training in loving kindness have often been influenced by another set of instructions. And those set of instructions came hundreds of years after the Buddha's time, and they were developed and codified and protected on palm leaves for long enough to get to us here and now by the Venerable Buddhaghosa. The Venerable Buddhaghosa lived in Sri Lanka. And I had the opportunity this last spring to go, for the first time, spend a month studying and practicing in Sri Lanka. Amazing. I figured, oh, Theravadan Buddhist country I haven't been to yet. I want to go experience that on a cellular level. And boy, did I. I don't know if you remember the heat wave that came in last April through southern China and took so many lives, southeastern China, and down through Southeast Asia, and it also went through Sri Lanka. It was hot. I didn't know how hot. I knew that it was hot. I knew that the body was suffering. But when the locals started coming to me and going, wow, it's really hot. Are you okay? I would think to myself, you know, I was holding up until I realized that you aren't okay with the heat as locals. It became a little bit harder to bear. Since we're weaving this a bit of a random thread through this reflection, starting with Ajahn Chah's Who's Bothering Who? Here's a connected reflection about the body and the comfort of the body and heat. It comes from one of my early teachers, Ajahn Jimnyan, who is from southern Thailand, very, very hot. And so he would come to the U.S. to teach and in the summer, and it would be hot, and we'd all be fanning ourselves. And he'd just start laughing and say, you know, the body is hot. Yes, I see that it's hot outside. The body is hot, but I am not hot. The body is hot, but I, the solid, separate, preferencing, liking, disliking, opinionated sense of self, does not have to be hot. It's a choice. So I was in Sri Lanka this spring, and one of many kind of Dharma adventures, but one relevant to this reflection, is that in the very center of the island of Sri Lanka, near the town of Dambala, there is a monastery that's dedicated to the memory of Venerable Buddhaghosa. So I had an opportunity to go there and visit. And the first thing that happened when I walked in the door. And it's kind of this, they had a visitor center for foreigners. You could call it that. I'm not sure what they would call it. I walked in the door, and I turned and glanced to my left and just stopped. Because to my left, there are these, I could say, kind of bookshelves. They were nothing special. All the way across the room, this wall. And there's these stacks and stacks of palm leaves. And I realize that I'm looking at the Tipitaka on palm leaves. The whole canon. I'm not promising it was the entirety of the canon, but it was a lot of the canon. And I just stopped. And then there was a very friendly gentleman who was working there who took the time to pull out a leaf and show me how the ink was made in the old style with different elements and the way that it's stirred together and the implement that's used that's been used for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to actually make the indentations over which the ink is put to write in the old language of the Pali, these teachings. Amazing. So then I went up further in the monastery to Buddhaghosa's cave, and there's this very famous cave in Sri Lanka where Buddhaghosa was said to have meditated, and I'm sure also loving kindness. And so here's the cave, and it's a little bit gaudy the way sometimes Thai and Sri Lankan Theravada Buddhism can manifest, and so these kind of interesting brightly colored painted statues of Buddhaghosa and his followers. But if I didn't pay too much attention to that and just sat down in the cave, which is what I did, it was amazing. I mean, you could just feel the samadhi, the concentration, the loving kindness. You could just feel how much practice had happened there for I don't know how long. You know, you think about it. How long have you all been practicing here in this room with this church? How many years? Give or take. Close to 10, somewhere in that range. It's so different when you first inhabit a space. I experienced this when we opened the new meditation center for Mountain Stream. Because Mountain Stream Meditation has been a 501c3 nonprofit for over 25 years, but we never had a home. And out of the generosity of a few major donors, out of the generosity of an entire team who remodeled the house that was offered to us for free, including moving a load-bearing wall and knocking out a few other walls so that we had a really nice meditation hall, putting in some new windows, all out of generosity. The people who figured out how to run events at the place, all generosity. And so there we are opening the center. And I remember when we first started sitting there, it was this beautiful center, but it felt a little bit empty. And I don't mean empty like sunyata, profound emptiness. I mean empty like it was missing something. Everything was there. We had all the cushions. We had all the chairs. We had beautiful tankas on the walls. Everything was prepared. And yet, there was something missing. Some lack of juice. Some energetic that hadn't been activated yet. That can be activated anywhere. As we come together in communities and keep developing these practices, the spaces change. Which is part of why there are so many people engaged in practices of different kinds on the planet right now, different places on the planet, different groups hooking in through the internet for peace, for actually changing the unseen structure of a place. Okay. So this is definitely the world of metta and the world of the story with the Buddha. And I'm in a cave in Sri Lanka, Buddhaghosa's cave to be precise, feeling extremely grateful for all the blessings that had to come together for me to end up in Sri Lanka in that cave. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have said impossible. There was just no seeds that would have possibly created that scenario 10 years ago. I started to hear some noise. So now we're going to weave back to the Ajahn Chah story, I see. Started to hear some noise, kind of like a low roar in the distance. As the low roar got louder, I realized, oh, it's school children. And I knew that sound because I worked with youth for 20 years of various different ages. I'm like, that's the sound of a big group of kids. And it's getting louder. I'm like, that's the sound of a really big group of kids. Groups can be quite large in Sri Lanka compared to a lot of groups in the U.S. And it's getting louder and louder, and the thought arose, oh, the magic of the cave is about to be disturbed. And I thought to myself, you know, I had my moment, and this is their moment, and yeah, I came halfway around the world, and they probably just came up the block. But who's more important? No one. Everyone gets their time. I had my time. Now it's changing. So I started to open up to the sound of these kids, and they started coming up the stairs and coming up the stairs, and I mean, there were like 200 kids. I got out of the way, and they came in and chattering, and I don't know what they got out of the cave, but planted good seeds. You know, sometimes we come and meditate somewhere and go, oh, that was okay. And then 10 years later, something happens, and all of a sudden we go, oh, that was it. Planted good seeds, those kids. You know, I could have shut down. I could have been a big farong, you know, a foreigner. Said, can you give me a minute? Like, I'm important. Could have done a lot of things. Instead, I just opened. This friendliness, this basic friendliness. So the monks who just received the new teachings from the Buddha, friends, have I got a practice for you? This is what should be done by those who are skilled in goodness and who know the path of peace. And he gave them the whole sutta, as one story goes. Sent them back up the mountain to the foothills of the Himalayas to continue their meditation. Now, it's important to note that loving-kindness and the other heart practices are all concentration practices. We don't tend to teach them that way here in the U.S. We don't tend to train in them here in the U.S., but they are. And they can actually lead to states of body and mind that are incredibly vital, enlivened, blissful, happy, contented, peaceful, and still. Which is like a feet on the ground organic way of talking about the first four jhanas. Okay? It's like we get so, I don't know, obsessed with ideas about concentration sometimes. When the heart and mind are not startled or angry or confused, friendliness is available. Benevolence is available, and collectedness of mind and body are available. So they go and they practice. They practice metta and they practice it as concentration. What happens next? What happens next is the force of the radiation of their loving kindness starts to transform the space around them, the environment around them. And it affects not just the seen, but the unseen, including these devas. And so the devas are transformed from hindering forces to, you could even say, the enemy, into something else. Something starts to soften, something starts to connect, and the very, very energetics and forces that were the hindrances transform into the allies for these monastics and protect them energetically for the rest of their retreat. The end of that story. But I think that that, in some ways, is the most powerful part of the story. Because if we start to orient to that which trips us up, that which we formerly would have labeled a problem, and we begin to orient it to it as a wake-up call, as a potential ally, as a teacher, as something that can actually be worked with, workable, manageable, that is a totally different relationship, and it's a relationship filled with friendliness, benevolence, and goodwill that is metta. The shift is in the attitude of mind. So when I first started studying that in one of the commentaries, and that's not, you don't find that story in a sutta, it's in one of the commentaries. It was really helpful to me. And just checking out what was being identified as a problem that could be something else. A wake-up call, a teacher, an opportunity. One of my teachers puts it like this: if you experience something and you see it as an obstacle, it's an obstacle. That very same thing happens and you see it as an opportunity, it's an opportunity. It's that simple. And so, through the force of the radiation of the monastics' loving kindness, their hearts were transformed and awakened more, and the immediate environment was also impacted. We know this in daily life. You know how when you walk into a room and everybody's stressed or grouchy and you're not, how easy it is to catch the stress and grouchiness? If you've got any seeds of stress and grouchiness and you move into a room where it's there, they're likely to start growing something. And when we actually see what's happening and realize that we don't have to contribute to it and make the choice to offer something else, not always, but miracles happen. I mean, entire conversations can transform, and we actually see that in peacekeeping work. Whether it was Gandhi sitting down for tea with one of the English officials and saying, you know, listening to all this contention and saying, I hear you, friend. Let's keep talking. Here, have another cup of tea. So it just wore the official down. Through patience, bearing witness, courage. It's a very simplified version of that story. So let's move on in the sutta a little bit further. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish every single living being, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. One should sustain this recollection. We tend to do more reflecting on this potent line, even as a mother protects with her life, even as a parent protects with their life, their child, their only child. Tonight I'd like to reflect more on how when we open to one, we open to many. This works with the wisdom side too. When we experience directly impermanence with anything, that can open to be understanding for all things. So that we don't have to make a project of seeing everything without exception with impermanence. We might get exhausted. You just see one thing deeply and it expands out. Perhaps that's why Buddhaghosa laid it out with the categories in metta, which I call muses, that we start with one to wish well to, and we start where it's easier. And through the connection and the intimacy and the depth with that one, it automatically begins to radiate out to more and more and more and more until it's boundless. A lot of us have been trained in loving kindness, really emphasizing phrases of well-wishing, metta wishes. How many of you have done that practice before? That's what I figured. It's okay if you haven't. That's a great training.
And at a certain point, the phrases, as some of us have discovered, actually start to get quieter and quieter and quieter. And I teach the Metta Retreat at Spirit Rock every year, and every year somebody or several people come in and say something like, just can't even produce the wishes anymore. Maybe one word, safe, happy. Just quieter and quieter. And what's left is actually the feeling. At a certain point, it's not about who and it's not about the wishes. It's about this expansion of mind, heart, body in benevolence, in caring. It isn't even about metta anymore. The caring, the balance of mind, the gratitude when it's appropriate. It starts to expand out of the box of the form and into its essence. And that's really what these instructions are pointing to. Now, straight from the suttas, it says, above and below and around and everywhere and to all as to myself, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Yeah? So the Buddha's talking about like all directions, all times. Because when the mind starts waking up, the reflection of that awakening are these awakened states of heart, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. We cultivate them and they're also fruition. And so it starts waking up and it starts moving outside of the bounds of space and boundary, the bounds of time, past, present, future, and the bounds of self. Now, of course, we have to do the work to develop a healthy sense of self before we can open like that and maintain it. And also, we have to develop a strong relationship with concentration and that aspect of the practice, again, in order for the stability and steadiness of that boundlessness. Otherwise, it does more of this pendulation. Whoop, poom, whoop, poom. It's the first time I've had a soundtrack for it, but well, there's not enough concentration, steadiness of mind. So it opens, we experience it, and then it collapses again. And that's fine. It's just called, okay, keep going. One of my favorite non-traditional metta sayings is, I love you, keep going. Great antidote to doubt. And so we move into the boundless from there. And the Buddha acknowledges, which I appreciate so much, ours and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. All postures are equally relevant to wake up in an ordinary way and in an extraordinary way. We tend to overemphasize the sitting posture. The problem with that is what about the times our body just can't maintain that posture? We're tired. We stand up. We stand around waiting to get less tired so we can do the real practice sitting. That's not it. It's easy enough to have happen, but it's not it. So that's why part of why I led the Qigong, so that we re-remember a venerable standing posture for practice that has been practiced for hundreds of years. We get sick, and we can only lie down. And that's the time we really need metta and compassion. All postures, free from drowsiness. So it closes. So that whole piece is the meditation piece. So if we have the three baskets, integrity, meditation, and wisdom, that's the meditation piece, the wishes and the radiation. Then we have the wisdom piece. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Now, there's some controversy that this last stanza was added after the time of the Buddha. And I'm not a Pali scholar, and I'm not interested in wasting precious life energy arguing over this.
What I am interested in is what I can learn from it as a practitioner. Can I be inspired? Is it helpful? Now, a lot of times when people would argue with the Buddha or debate the Buddha, what he would throw back to them is, let's just track and see, is it skillful or is it unskillful? If it's skillful, we'll use it. If it's unskillful, we won't. And we'll just leave it there. So, again, that was a very simplified form of a modality that the Buddha uses, but worth thinking about. We've all got fixed views. And when we've got fixed views about another, I wish I had time to tell you the most amazing story about metta on an airplane to Southern Dharma this summer, but I don't. Let's see if I can distill it down. Okay, here are the headlines. <laughs> 12 hours before getting on a plane to teach at Southern Dharma in North Carolina, outside of Asheville. I missed a step carrying a big heavy box, going down to get my suitcase and sprained my ankle. We don't know how precious mindfulness is until we have a lapse. So I'm teaching the retreat solo, and I've never taught there before, and I think to myself, am I even going to be able to pull this off? How am I even going to get on the airplane? This is a long story. And the answer is I taught the retreat. It went fantastically. And you know what I learned? Is that the world is a benevolent place. And I say that as a catalyst because I know, like you do, the world is filled with reactivity and violence. And the world is a benevolent place when I have eyes to see. And so I could tell you half a dozen stories about the benevolence of complete strangers. But on the 5-hour flight, I thought to myself, I hope somebody nice sits next to me. And this huge family came down the row and sat next to me and all around me. Y'all probably had flights with young children right next to you and around you. I thought, oh man, it's getting worse, isn't it? I had a fixed view. I had an expectation. I had an idea about that family. If I had held that view, that fixed view, the miracle that happened could have never happened. They helped me with my eyes. The father advocated for me for the person in the seat in front of me who pushed their seat all the way into my face so I couldn't put my foot up, and I was too depleted to advocate for myself. And he stood up for a complete stranger, to a man who did not want to push his seat back, for a complete stranger. And towards the end of the flight, he had his son sit on the edge of the seat to watch his video so that I could put my foot up with ice. And when I said to him, I don't want your son's eyes to be damaged by the close video, he said to me, ma'am, please do not be concerned. I'm here with my family. It was 3 generations, abuela, mom, dad, the 2 kids. They were from Guatemala. I'm here with my family. In my family, we practice kindness and giving. We practice it with each other, and we practice it with others. Please do not be concerned. I wept. My teacher, if I kept the fixed view about who they were and what they were about and, you know, everything that I might have perceived about them, I would have never had that experience. By not holding to fixed views, the heart purifies. And clarity of vision shines forth. They waited until everybody departed the plane and got my bags down and walked them out for me and handed them to me. And all I could say was, what is your name? And he said, Raphael. And I said, Raphael, I'm going to pray for you and your family. And he said, thank you. Because that's what you say when you're on an airplane. You don't say, I'm going to send metta to you and your family. He doesn't know what the hell that means. So I'm going to pray for you. And I think of them every day. We don't have to be born again into these fixed views, into our sense of self and other. There's something else available. So that's a very spontaneous Metta Sutta reflection. I hope that it's helpful as you continue chanting this teaching. And I hope it inspires you in moments the way it inspires me.